WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moskowain. One of the words I learned studying for the vocabulary section of the SAT was contumacious, meaning scornfully insubordinate. I have never used that word in real life, although I never forgot it. The new SAT, which was just announced by the College Board, is getting rid of those so-called SAT words and replacing them with more relevant everyday language. The board is also making other significant changes to the test. College Board President David Coleman said the overhaul will make the SAT fairer and more useful. He also criticized the test prep industry, saying the test had become a better assessment of privilege than of merit. So, will the new SAT be a better SAT? We begin our conversation with Nick Anderson. He's higher education reporter for the Washington Post and joins us from their studios. And Nick Anderson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. Do you think this was a decision based as much on business as on academics? And I ask that knowing that the SAT has been losing students to the ACT and that there are more than 800 colleges that are test optional colleges.
Well, if you talk to the College Board, I think they will insist that it's about making a better test. Let me just sort of state their case on this. They say that they are trying to take the tricks out of the test. They say that they don't want to confuse students. They want to challenge them. They say that they want students to go in depth and to have questions that are real world, relevant, sort of the kinds of things that students might encounter in classroom experiences, and less sort of gamesmanship. So that's their case. And they've done a number of things to the test. And it, by the way, it hasn't taken effect. It takes effect in 2016. But they're doing a number of things to the test to try to make it more straightforward. Now, is that about business or academics? Well, on its face, a test is about academics, a student interacting with something that's being assessed. But also, of course, you have to factor in that the admissions process in America has many facets. There is the SAT, there is the ACT, which is another standardized test that is actually more widely used in the United States and is gaining ground on the SAT in a number of states where the SAT had been sort of dominant for generations. Then you have, you just alluded to, the test optional movement, which is still very much a minority slice of higher education, but it's a number of colleges that are saying, hey, if you want to apply to us, you don't have to submit a test score. Now, there are a fair number of big name colleges that are doing this, but they're still the minority. Most selective colleges that you've heard of are still asking for a test score from the ACT or the SAT.
Well, and David Coleman, the president of the College Board, talked about the fact that the SAT had become, quote, disconnected from high school work. The goal is then to reconnect or to connect the SAT to what students are actually studying in school?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting statement on his part, because when you go back to the history of these tests, the SAT was originally meant to be something that was kind of testing students' aptitude. By the way, it's no longer the Scholastic Aptitude Test. It's just SAT. They got rid of the whole aptitude idea. But the notion was, let's test how students think. And that was the SAT's kind of prevailing idea from its genesis in 1926. The ACT was much more centered on curriculum and what students had achieved in school, a different proposition in testing. Now, I suspect that for all these years, the SAT, frankly, has been seeking to be connected to the classroom in various ways. But it also aimed to sort of transcend the classroom, so that, and the theory behind it actually was originally kind of egalitarian. You know, you wanted to get a handle on who a student is and how they think, regardless of what kind of curriculum they had been exposed to.
Well, And it's interesting that in these changes that the vocabulary section has gotten so much attention. I talked about the word contumacious, which I've never used in my entire life except during this hour here. But the idea of making words more what people actually might say in their everyday life, is that a significant change?
Well, sure it is. But, you know, as a writer who thinks about words for a living, I kind of worry about that a little bit. I enjoy fancy words myself. I enjoy reading them. I enjoy writing them from time to time. Never in a way that, you know, puts people off or, you know, sort of diminishes access to our stories, but in a way that sort of pulls people in. And I think that there will be some debate about this internally in the College Board and perhaps externally once the new tests come out, because you do want a test that has an expectation that people can really read substantively and widely, and that frankly requires decent vocabulary.
Another change is to make the essay optional, and the essay had come under a fair amount of criticism.
Right.
What was the pushback on the essay section of the SAT?
Well, I think actually this is the critical piece of the whole story. So in 2005. The SAT made a big change. It added the essay as part of a writing section. That changed a number of things. It changed the test length. It went up from 3 hours to about 3 hours and 45 minutes. It changed the test scoring. The top score went up from 1,600 to 2,400. It changed what students were being asked to do. In previous generations, there had not been an essay requirement. That writing test on the SAT is getting a big overhaul. And what they're doing is they're taking the essay out of the required part, and they're going to make it optional. But at the same time, they're going to beef it up.
Huh.
So what had been a 25-minute essay is going to be a 50-minute essay. What had been an essay prompt that asks students to draw on their own personal background and experiences to make a point and argue a point, now is actually going to present students with information and ask them to assess it. And that's a very different kind of essay. It's an essay that David Coleman, the president of the College Board, very much wants to institute, because he thought that the previous essay just was kind of weak. It bothered him. So that's the essay. But the thing is that the colleges are of mixed minds about the essay. Some like it, some don't. Some like the idea of requiring it, some don't, regardless of whether the essay is more substantial or not. And so they decided to go optional with the essay. We'll see what that means in practice. You know, for a lot of students who are applying to the selective schools, they might be told, well, even though the SAT says that's optional, you still have to do it.
Right. The sort of implicit is that this is something that you want to do. One of the other, I think, fairly enduring criticisms of the SAT is that it's that family income, and I think even family education, is a much better predictor of how someone does when they get to college or to university, and the fact that well-off kids can take these prep courses, and it creates a very unfair and uneven and unequal system.
Well, yeah, the thing about family income is this permeates all levels of education from pre-K on up through grad school. If you are coming from families of privilege where there's books in the home and resources that enable you to be the best student you can be, well, gosh, that's going to give you an edge. That's giving you an edge from nursery school on up, practically from birth on up. So it's not really surprising that the SAT would have a correlation between income and scores. Now, what is interesting is that the College Board is saying, okay, let's attack this problem. Let's say you can get free preparation on the SAT from a free online and highly respected tutorial provider. It's called the Khan Academy.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
It's an interesting idea. There are plenty of people who are skeptical of that. We'll see how it plays out. I think the test preparation industry is not going to take this sitting down. They will undoubtedly try to market themselves as the new guides to the new SAT.
Well, in fact, I was reading that the test preparation industry is something like $1 billion a year. Did I read that right?
You might have. I'm actually not on the business staff of the Post, so I haven't sussed out exactly how big that industry is, but I know it's huge.
Right.
There's Kaplan, there's Princeton Review, there's Barron's, there's even the College Board. There's the College Board, if you go into Barnes & Noble or any of the other bookstores and look for SAT prep books, well, you can find and buy one from the College Board.
Well, in fact, this report or even Coleman says is that these prep courses really intimidate parents, and that's a quote from one of the comments that came out of this.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder whether the parents are intimidated or whether the parents just simply have a yen to get ahead. When you are affluent and you have kids and you're thinking to yourself, well, what's the best investment I can make? Well, you probably want to spend some money on your kids. So it may not, depending on the circumstance, it may be the parents themselves seeking this out rather than being browbeat into doing it. However it happens, it happens. Parents are definitely thinking about this when kids are applying to college. Kids are thinking about it. And let's not forget, you know, they all want an edge, too. They're very sophisticated. Kids know if they're applying to the selective schools in the United States, they know that their odds of getting into the super, super duper selective schools are small. And so they want to try to get any edge they can.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, Nick, and what I took the SATs back in the 1960s. I still remember not only my terrible scores, but also the headache that I had through that entire test. What's your memory of taking the SAT?
Well, I grew up in California. I took it myself a couple times. I had a result once that I was so-so with. I had the second result. It went up, and I was happy with. And, you know, I kind of thought of testing as just part of life in school. It wasn't like the SAT was this big different thing that I had to do. It was kind of part of a piece of all of what we had to do in school. So I don't really remember it with
such fondness.
with any kind of fear or loathing. It just was. It was part of the process.
Well,
for
thanks.
Me.
Fair enough. And Nick Anderson, thanks for getting our conversation started. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's higher education reporter for the Washington Post. In fact, joined us from their studios. We have Bob Schaefer waiting in the wings. He's a public education director of Fair Test, a critic of the SAT. And we'll also be talking with Philip Ballinger from the University of Washington, who has some interesting things to say about the SAT, old and new. We want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Treasures from Korea, Arts and Culture of the Joseon Dynasty, the first full-scale American exhibition devoted to the art of the Joseon Dynasty. 500 years of tradition, ritual, and honor from a line of 27 kings that shaped contemporary Korea. The exhibition brings many Korean national treasures to the U.S. for the first time. On view through May 26th. Tickets and info at philamuseum.org.
The world moves quickly.
And information is bombarding us from all directions. TV, newspapers, the internet.
You need Morning Edition, NPR's weekday news magazine, to slow down that news.
To help you make sense of it.
Not by accepting the quick, easy answer.
But by asking more questions, digging deeper.
Helping you to understand the story behind the headlines.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, we'll visit the Jackson, Mississippi historic home of the late, great Southern writer Eudora Welty.
I really love to write. It's almost like the pleasure of reading. Well, it is the same.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about last week's announcement, the College Board saying that the SAT will be undergoing an overhaul with changes taking effect in the spring of 2016. These changes include making the essay optional, also using vocabulary that are more relevant, using more relevant words as part of the vocabulary test. And joining us now is Bob Schaefer, Public Education Director of Fair Test. That's a National Center for Fair and Open Testing, a standardized test watchdog group that is based in Massachusetts. Bob Schaefer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
So is there anything in this new SAT that you favor?
Well, making the essay optional is certainly a good move. It restores the SAT to what it was before 2005 and matches the process on the rival test, the ACT. But most of the changes are simply bells and whistles that don't address the test's fundamental flaws. It's not a good predictor of college performance. It's not a level playing field, particularly for women, minority, and older students. And it remains highly susceptible to pricey coaching courses, which are like steroids affluent parents can buy to boost their children's scores.
I want to pick up on all of that. Why are women and older students disadvantaged by the SAT?
The test maker's own research shows that the test underpredicts the performance of females in college and overpredicts for males. That's important because the sole scientific claim for the test is its capacity to predict first-year grades, but it's wrong for more than half the population. It says that women are not as strong academically when, in fact, they do better in high school and college. For students who've been out of school for more than 2 or 3 years, the test is a new experience for them. They've been out of the testing game, and their scores are artificially depressed simply by lack of experience with filling in multiple choice bubbles. They may know a lot more from being in the workforce or experiencing life. And again, the test makers say that it's underpredicted for them and for kids whose first language is not English.
Is the ACT, that's another test that people take, and it seems like a little, we're talking about different regions of the country, is the ACT a better predictor, a better test from your perspective?
The ACT is a different test, though much less so, since all the changes being made to the SAT are to adopt characteristics that have long been part of the ACT. But the ACT is not a better test in terms of its predictive value, its fairness, or its susceptibility to coaching. The truth is, Marty, that independent research has shown time and time again that high school records, particularly grades, and the rigor of the courses a student takes are a better predictor of who's likely to graduate than any one-shot test possibly can be.
So there is no standardized test that can really predict how someone's going to do in college or university?
Well, they're both weak predictors. Grades are a stronger predictor. And why do you need a lesser set of data when you already have something better? I mean, it's like baseball. The way you decide who gets promoted to the major leagues is who does well in the minor leagues. You look at that performance, not a simple snapshot of one aspect of it, which is all that the best multiple choice exam can possibly give you.
Is part of the problem the multiple choice?
Yes, indeed. Part of the problem is the multiple choice fixation of the test makers, and it's understandable. It's a function of time and money constraints. But how many multiple choice tests does anyone take in college or let alone in life? The test is a very good measure of how well you take tests, but that's not a large component of your undergraduate, graduate school, or work experience.
Let me ask you about school grades, because it seems to me that, you know, an A or a B could mean different things from district to district, from school to school, even from teacher to teacher. How does a college, or how could a college know that someone's B-level work really would be the same, someone's B-level work, let's say here in Philadelphia, is the same as someone's B-level work in Massachusetts where you are?
Well, your criticism is exactly right, and it's one that we hear all the time. In fact, there's no question that grades are incredibly variable. But researcher after researcher, including the test makers, finds that the high school grades predict better than the test does. And that shows you how really weak a predictor the mm-hmm. test is. We also have a real-world example, which are the 800-plus test-optional colleges, like Franklin and Marshall there in Philadelphia, that do test-optional admissions and find that they get superior classes academically and more diversity as a result of de-emphasizing standardized tests or ignoring them from students who choose not to submit those test scores and looking simply at high school records and other factors in the application portfolio.
There was an article about the SAT, including some comments about Franklin and Marshall, which is in Lancaster. But it mm-hmm. seems that even part of their opting out or being sort of on the fence, I guess, about an SAT is that they seem also to be very proactive, looking for students who might not rise to the top but have a lot of potential and a lot of skills.
Yes, and that's particularly praiseworthy and, indeed, a very good undercovered piece of what the College Board announced at its news conference is that they are going to be more aggressive in encouraging first-generation and other low-income students to apply to college. That's a real positive. You don't need test scores to do that, however, as Franklin and Marshall has shown.
But what is a large state university? I'm thinking of Penn State here in Pennsylvania. Thousands and thousands of students, and many more thousands, obviously applying. I'm sure Massachusetts has your version of a state university system. How do they how can an admissions officer make a decision about a student applying for a college?
Well, the truth is that many state university systems have always been test optional. The University of Arizona, for example, and in a wonderful inadvertent experiment, the University of Texas system, because of a law passed called the Top 10% Law, is required to admit any student from any high school in the state who graduates with a college prep curriculum in the top 10% of her or his class into the University of Texas at Austin. And they've done very careful research and found that those top 10%ers do better than kids admitted under the normal system where SAT scores matter. In fact, they get higher grades than kids who got at SAT scores 100 to 150 points higher. Grades matter. They show what you can do in school. Test scores show how well you can take a test.
What do you think, and then I do want to get to some of our callers, what do you think of the idea of having Khan Academy, which has these online courses, as making that part of what students and perhaps even their families can access without having to pay a lot of money for these test prep courses?
Well, it's good. It's a good thing that Khan Academy is going to be making more test prep videos for the SAT. They already have some.
Right.
And in fact, if your listeners chose to do a web search for free SAT prep, they discovered that there are thousands of products out there already that are already free or low cost. This may be slightly better. We haven't seen the videos that the Khan Academy produces, but there's no question that affluent parents will still be able to buy higher quality test prep through workshops run by companies like Kaplan or Princeton Review, and FairTest has no connection to the coaching industry. Don't make a nickel from it.
Gotcha.
Or hiring personal tutors in markets like Philadelphia, where they cost $100 to $500 an hour, or paying for the very specialized coaching that exists, $25,000 to $40,000 for the best tech prep gurus to spend a week with your daughter or your son.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question that individualized, personalized, customized coaching gives you a much greater edge in any area: speech coaching, life coaching, writing coaching, and indeed test coaching, than watching videos.
Well, and if we're talking about these coaches, they're coaching them on how to take the test, right?
They're coaching. Good test prep is a mix of both test-specific skills, how to beat the test, how to pace yourself, what kind of questions directions, terrible instructions for life, great instructions for the test, because every second you spend reading the test questions is a second you can't spend on answering questions. And most kids don't finish most sections of the test. So skip the instructions, they haven't changed from last time, get right into the question, into the questions, and you'll score more points. Part of good coaching is also looking at a student's individual substantive weaknesses and improving those skills.
And that's Bob Schaefer, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about the announcement last week, the College Board making some changes to the SAT. And Bob Schaefer is a public education director of Fair Tests, again, a National Center for Fair and Open Testing, a standardized test watchdog group that is based in Massachusetts. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coaine. Let me get Michael from Brewery Town to join us. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, yes. How you doing? I like the comment. Basically, I agree with Mr. Schaefer that the SAT tests are somewhat an arbitrary zero because of the fact that, you know, just because of that test, it shouldn't, you know, dictate, you know, your future as far as college placement, things like that. And I believe that, you know, tests such as are a deterrent for a lot of students who have the educational capabilities to go forward in life. So.
No,
Fair Test completely agrees with the caller. Indeed, many talented people don't score well on these exams, and schools that rely on them create unnatural, unfair barriers to access to otherwise talented students. I mean, that's why 800-plus schools listed at fairtest.org, our website, including a ton in Pennsylvania, Muhlenberg, Juniata, King's College, Dickinson, Chatham, Elizabethtown, Gettysburg, are all test optional.
In fact, and I'm looking at the screen here, what Michael didn't say was that he had a good GPA, but he didn't do well on the standardized test. And I think there are a lot of people probably like Michael that can perform in one arena, but not necessarily in this other.
And those are the young people for whom test optional colleges are the perfect alternative.
Is there something also about timed tests that there are certain kinds of students that just don't do well on a timed test?
Indeed. The SAT is a fast-paced, multiple-choice guessing game, which, until the changes in 2016, penalize you for guessing wrong. And that creates a very stressful climate for some students. There is indeed a diagnosed medical condition called test anxiety. You can treat it with beta blockers and things like that.
Really?
But students who don't know that they have it end up with depressed scores, not because they don't know the subject, but because the time limit, and by the way, the time limit exists for the test maker's convenience, not because it's an integral part of the exam. Those time limits put pressure on many students and makes them look worse than their abilities really are.
Do you remember your SAT? I'm assuming you took the SAT. Do you remember your scores?
Yes, I do.
And were they okay?
No, they were extraordinarily high, he says.
Okay. Because mine were extraordinarily low. But no, go ahead, Bob.
I'm a very, very good test taker. But it doesn't mean anything other than I can take tests. I could pass the Golf Pro licensing exam written component with a week of study. I couldn't hit a golf ball straight.
Let me see what Bob from Elkins Park has to say. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have three children, and I will say that I'm going to be 65 next month, but I'm still terrorized by the SATs, I think, in so many ways.
Bad memories, eh?
But I don't think it's a predictor of anything whatsoever, other than, as your guest said, that you can take a good test. You know, you're not... I was an extraordinarily good student, as were my children, but we were all terrible test takers. And eventually, you know, but I was called down by the guidance counselor and told I had applied to five schools. I'd never get into any of them. And that I had to, it was at the time when you did it at Temple and Penn were easier to get into or whatever. And she said, I want you to do that. And I said, I was never, told never to talk back to an adult, but I said, I'm not doing it. I'm not staying in Philadelphia. I'm going outside of Philadelphia somewhere, and I was accepted to all of them, and I eventually became a Phi Beta Kappa, as did my son. But my whole first year, I was terrorized by these things, and My test scores were so low, it was horrifying in comparison to my grades.
Well, that's very... No, that's very interesting, Bob, and it's also interesting that that was kind of what we heard from our first caller, Bob Schaefer, which was, you know, this discrepancy between grades and an SAT score.
And Marty, how many times we hear that story. The SAT sets up barriers to access to those kids, and it creates a psychological situation in which they believe they're their score instead of their real ability and actual academic performance.
Do employers care about SAT scores? Have you looked at that, Bob?
Oh yes, we have, and some unfortunately do, even though the test maker explicitly warns them not to do so. The SAT has one scientific claim: its capacity to predict first-year college grades. It doesn't do that very well.
Hmm.
No employer should ever use it, but some do. McKinsey, the big consulting firm, does. Several high-tech firms do. It makes no sense because it is designed for a totally different purpose.
Bob, thanks for the call. Let me get, looks like Ethan from Kennett Square to join our conversation. Ethan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have a kind of a different experience from those first two callers. I went to Swarthmore College, which is very selective, and I did very well on my SATs 25 years ago now. But one of the things that I'm concerned about now and was concerned about then was that people get so wrapped up in prepping themselves to go to college. So you're 18 years old and you're trying to make wrap yourself up and put a shiny bow on yourself as the person who is now ready to you know, appear on the college campus and be the perfect student. And I think the SAT prep and the degree to which people get so focused on doing well on those tests is part of a trend in which we're asking our 18-year-olds to be finished people rather than asking them to explore who they are and be interesting and try to provide a wealth of experience to a college campus rather than being that perfect person.
Well, Ethan, I appreciate that call to Radio Times, very thoughtful, and Bob Schaefer, about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, but I'd be curious about your response to Ethan's comments.
Fair test agrees with every word that he said.
I kind of figured
that. The SAT has set up a situation in which people believe that there is a college admissions arms race and that they have to buy the best test prep weaponry they possibly can to compete with other students. Far better to read a book, work in a soup kitchen, learn about nature than to practice taking tests. And going to test optional schools helps students find institutions that match up with those interests, not how well you fill in bubbles.
Well, on that note, Bob Schaefer, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. He's Public Education Director of FAIR Test, again, a standardized test watchdog group that is based in Massachusetts, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. And we're talking about the new and perhaps improved SAT. We have Philip Ballinger waiting in the wings. We want to hear from you. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Guided by Quaker values, Folkways at Gwinnett, a continuing care retirement community for active adults 65 and over since 1967, supports WHYY. Folkways provides residents with proven financial stability, a comprehensive health care program, and a community where friendship, caring, dignity, and respect are a way of life. One- and two-bedroom apartments, highlighting Folkways' newest design features, are now available. To experience life at Folkways and to arrange a personal tour, 215-283-7010.
In 1998, writer Walter Kern did a favor for a New York man he didn't know, a man who said he was a Rockefeller. The two became very good friends. Years into their friendship, Kern discovered the man was not only an imposter, but had committed a gruesome murder. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Walter Kern. His new book is called Blood Will Out. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. In his new book, The Gift of Adversity, psychiatrist Norman Rosenthal shares his belief that adversity is by far the best teacher most of us will ever encounter. He draws on his upbringing in apartheid South Africa, his career researching seasonal affective disorder, and the legacies of his heroes, among them Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, adversity as a basis of beneficial lifelong lessons. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking about some of the changes to the SAT, including more relevant vocabulary words, making the essay optional, and some other changes as well. Joining us now is Philip Ballinger, Associate Vice Provost for Enrollment and Undergraduate Admissions at the University of Washington. He's a relatively new trustee of the College Board, not involved in the revamp of the SAT. He also served on a National Commission that was critical of the use of standardized tests in college enrollment. And Philip Ballinger, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
So based on what you know about this new SAT, you certainly know about the current or the old SAT, do you see improvements?
Well, you know, the actual content of the test won't be available to everyone until mid-April, so it's difficult to be specific, but the change in approach, the change with regard to, you know, what test preparation could become, these things are very positive. So in that sense, I definitely see a difference.
One of the proposed changes is to make the test, I guess, closer to a school curriculum, less about how people think and more about how what students know. Does that seem like a good move to you?
It does. And, you know, that was one of the main recommendations that came out of the commission that you referred to that I was a member of, and so it is a good move. The new president of the College Board, David Coleman, is one of the authors of Common Core standards that are being adopted by the majority of states. So I think he's a true believer, and we see this in the changes recommended. Mm.
Do you like the idea of taking out those quote-unquote SAT words and putting in words that students are more likely to use or maybe even know?
You know, I have to say I was kind of neutral on how the test was given with reference to words. I like the emphasis on evidence-based reading and evidence-based writing. I thought of all the things I heard that was most encouraging to me.
Mm. How about the idea of the essay being optional, and which would have, of course, changed the scoring from 2,400 to 1,600?
Yeah, well, you know, I was a pretty strong proponent of adding a writing section to the examinations, and my university has certainly found it useful. My understanding is that the new SAT is going to do some pretty substantial, you know, testing relative to writing and writing skills, especially evidence-based writing and writing skills. So, so I think I'll claim to be neutral on that one.
We were hearing from Bob Schaefer that school grades are just a much better predictor of how ready a student is for college work and how well they do. As a college admissions person, do you agree with that?
Well, yes and no. First of all, whenever I hear absolutes, my cynical yellow light starts flashing, and in this case, it flashes pretty brightly. I mean, I think another recommendation that came from the commission was that each college and university needs to determine, mm-hmm. one, how predictive tests are for their purposes, and two, if they're useful for their purposes, right? So, for example, you had asked the question about GPA and the variance in GPA. Now, just looking at high schools and students that come to the University of Washington from high schools across the state of Washington, I can tell you that we do very close measurements over a period of years. It involves tens of thousands of students. And we know what the GPA of a student from a particular high school is upon entrance. And when you have many, many students from a high school coming over a period of time, and you look at that GPA and then also look at the GPA at the end of the first year and going forward, you get a sense of what a GPA, at least in a given time frame, and for us it's a 3-year period, means. And that differential between those two GPAs varies from positive 0.3 to negative 1.71.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I would say to, you know, that one has to take care and also to have data that they analyze.
So how does the University of Washington then, how do you view an SAT number or series of numbers?
Sure, yeah. Well, another recommendation that came from the commission was really not so much about the test, but about how colleges and universities use or in some cases misuse the test. And I think your question kind of addresses that to some degree. If a test is used in a cut score fashion, so for example, for admission or scholarship, if a university is making a decision based on some minimum score, right? And if you're below a line, you're out. If you're above a line, you're in. That's a misuse. I mean, that's straight out of misuse. It's an uncontextualized use of the test. And the commission, you know, warned against that very strongly. The test is useful in context. So, for example, going back to data again, and this is something that all colleges and universities should do, I can tell you that if I'm looking at single factors, that the most predictive factors for first-year GPA at the University of Washington is not the GPA uncontextualized.
Hmm.
It's actually the SAT math and SAT writing score. And if I take the SAT, all three scores together, it's even more predictive than an uncontextualized GPA. However, if I have additional information about schools, curriculum, about the student himself or herself, then I'm going to have the possibility of making much better decisions. The other part about the test is, you know, we think about them as undergraduate admission tests, and they're certainly that, but, you know, for universities that also have a mission, as mine does, that we seek to enroll students from underserved populations, students that are first-generation college students, et cetera, you know, test scores can be also used to help us determine what kind of support mechanisms we'll have to have in place for a particular student if we admit him or her.
We've already had a couple of callers who have said, you know, I was a pretty good student, but a terrible test maker, or test taker, I should say, as someone who has to pour through lots of criteria and information that you get from students. How do you deal with a student like that, where it just looks like that SAT score is just so out of whack?
Yeah, and then there I think is where context comes in. So, for example, let's say a student applies from a school that offers rich opportunities in terms of the kinds of courses available to the student. You know, do they have AP courses that they could take, or IB courses, and if the student made good and maybe even full advantage, took those kinds of courses and got good grades and then has a relatively weak score, then that's going to contextualize the score.
Mm.
However, let's take this another student from the same school that doesn't make use of the curriculum opportunities, gets pretty good grades but has a weak score, then that score might be more meaningful.
Let me get some callers in. We have Michael from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been reviewing college admissions files for a long time. I just have two kind of radical suggestions that I wanted to get your thoughts on quickly. Number one, I think to eliminate gaming the system, it might help to change the format of the exam unpredictably and randomly every time that you give it. That would guarantee that you're actually testing what students know instead of gaming the system. Number two, I think that it should be limited to one administration, because this is what I've seen as a great source of inequality by income, is that students who have a lot of money can take the test 8-10 times. So, thanks.
Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Philip Ballinger, do you like the idea of, I guess, changing the content of the test? And I don't know how easy that is to do.
Yeah, I'd leave that up to the psychometricians to figure that out. But the second suggestion, I think, is interesting. I mean, you know, one of the issues that we looked at closely on the commission that studied the use of standardized tests in undergraduate admissions was the whole test prep and industry, and also the disadvantages that come with family income. And those in part are connected to test prep, but I think they're also connected to what the caller refers to, which is more often than not, students that come from more affluent backgrounds are able to take the test many more times if they wish.
I'm actually looking at the commission report. This goes back to September 2008, just picking up on what you just said. As long as colleges and universities require standardized tests for admission, admission test preparation activities will thrive. And I guess the question is, even though the College Board president wants to address the test prep industry, one feels that the test prep industry will just prep for this particular version of the SAT.
I think that's absolutely true, but I think that, you know, the hope here is that the ground is changing a little bit, so that, you know, we hope to shift test prep from learning strategies and learning how to game a test to learning, and, you know, learning that's useful, learning skills that are useful both in school and life as opposed to skills useful for taking a specific test.
We have Peter from Wyomissing joining us on Radio Times. Peter, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was curious why the schools in America don't use the AP exams. One of my kids applied to some of the top-tier schools in England. They didn't care about his SAT score. They said, just give us the AP scores. Here it's the reverse. The AP scores, I gather, just go to registrars. They never get even seen. And so how does the school, the university here in the States, know whether or not the AP class at some prep school is the equivalent of the AP class at, say, Central High School or some public school? Thank you.
Peter, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Philip Ballinger, are AP classes or scores, is that helpful?
Well, it's a great topic and a great question. Well, first of all, I'm a huge fan of advanced placement and also international baccalaureate courses and courses that come out of Cambridge. Those are good examples of the kinds of courses we want students to take. A lot of applications are generally made at before any of the AP exams in the senior year are given, for the most part. So the AP exams that could be submitted are those that were probably taken at the end of the junior year. Right. And that being said, there are still universities, NYU is one, for example, that would take AP scores as part of a portfolio of demonstrating academic strength. So there are universities that would accept AP scores from an admission point of view, but there's some practical difficulties with that. That being said, though, AP courses and the associated examinations are wonderful, wonderful tools and wonderful possibilities for students.
And, of course, not everyone takes AP courses. Let me get Anna from Bethesda to join us on Radio Times. And, Anna, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'd just like to mention that everyone on this discussion has neglected to mention that the college, it's in the best interest of the colleges to use high SAT scores as a criteria for admission, because U.S. News and World Report and other such rankings of colleges actually use the SAT scores to rank the colleges, and for publicity purposes, for PR, the rankings. Harvard is number one. A large factor that plays into that is that they always have higher SAT scores than someone ranked than another college, let's say ranked at number 23, for instance.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because it's a really important issue that we did not talk about. Philip Ballinger, do you think Anna's right?
I think it's a really interesting topic, and wish we had more time to talk about this one. The test scores certainly are part of the weighted equation, so to speak, of the U.S. News and World Report rankings. They're a pretty small part, but still. But I connect this to the test optional thing. There can be wonderful reasons for an institution to choose to go test optional. For example, the test simply isn't that useful at that institution. But truthfully, my cynicism arises in the absence of data. If a test is not useful or even harmful, then why ask information about it at all? Hmm. Why is it even optional? So I think that the caller's question in that context is an interesting one.
Anna, thanks for the call. We have a tweet from Sam. The SAT and ACT scores are crucial for merit scholarships. Looks like my daughter missed additional $8,000 a year for 2 points on the ACT. You were talking about, sort of referencing this, I think, a bit earlier, Philip. Do you want to respond to that?
Well, I don't know the particulars, but it causes me concern when I hear something like that. I mean, obviously, when you have a large applicant pool and therefore you have to make fine distinctions, that's one thing. But if you have a school saying that if you have a 3.5 GPA and X score on whatever, you're going to get this scholarship, which means, of course, if you're a little bit below on either of those, you're not. I'm not sure that that's the best methodology.
Sam, thanks for that tweet. About a minute before we have to say goodbye, and this is really a Philadelphia question. I don't know if you know about the troubles that the Philadelphia public school system has been going through here, but they've had to lay off a number of many counselors, actually. And we hear about some of these large high schools in the city that might have just, you know, two or three counselors helping children, you know, make a decision about where to apply for college. And I just worry about the kind of disadvantages that those kids face. Is there anything a college like your college can do to help?
Well, we can certainly help. And my guess is that this occurs in the state of Pennsylvania as well. I'd have to talk to my colleagues at Penn State, but my guess is it certainly does. I know at the University of Washington, we actually, in some cases, have some of our people in high schools to basically add, if not simply give, college preparation and admission counseling. And these are these are positions that are funded via grants, federal and state grants. So they're not university specific, they're general positions. But otherwise you're left in a vacuum, and that vacuum truly disadvantages students. When a counselor has loads of 500 or 600 students, very little college counseling occurs. Their concerns are much more primary than that.
Well, Philip Ballinger, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. He's Associate Vice Provost for Enrollment and Undergraduate Admissions at the University of Washington, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to learn more about the program. Podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, it's all there for you to check out. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for the phone calls, and thanks for joining us. And do